Welcome to MoneyWeb Now. Business news every morning.
It's Friday and it's the 11th day of the 7th month of 2025. A very good morning to you and welcome to the MoneyWeb Now podcast with Simon Brown. I'm Duduzile Ramela in for Mr. Brown this morning. Here's what you can look forward to. Gary Boyson of Rand Swiss weighs in on NVIDIA's current valuation and what it means for tech-focused investors. PSG's Dirk Juster explains why investors often overlook the potential of low equity multi-asset funds in volatile markets. And Brandon de Kock from BrandMap talks to us about savings and investment choices of South Africa's customer class. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines: asking price trends show how Cape property soars. And that's a headline from MoneyWeb Business Day. Eskom moving to higher energy availability factor. Morning markets: US markets, the S&P 500 up 0.27%. NASDAQ closing at 0.9%, bolstered by an upbeat forecast from Delta Airlines and record close for NVIDIA. Commodities, gold futures 3,335, Brent 68.89, platinum 1,358, and palladium 1,138. The rand is trading at 17.74 to the US dollar. Bitcoin 116,520. Top 40 opening call expected 61 points. In the positive.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
A memorable week for NVIDIA as it became the first company with a market capitalization over $4 trillion. And we speak now with Gary Boyson of Rand Swiss. He weighs in on this. Thank you very much, Gary, for your time this morning. Good morning to you, by the way, and happy Friday. What's the NVIDIA
happy
story?
Happy Friday. Good morning to the listeners.
Yeah, so NVIDIA has been... an absolutely, I suppose, maybe not unique story, because many people look at it, look at the tech bubbles that we saw, around 2000, 2002, and say we've seen this picture before, but it does seem like this time it could be a little bit different. So how did it get here? So NVIDIA essentially laid the groundwork, through its GPU processing units, and specifically its CUDA platform, which is the developer tools that sit on top of that chipset, and have created something that is just best in breed. And with the rise of artificial intelligence, it really is the only absolutely the premium product when you're developing AI technology, and has had a meteoric rise. People that say that this is in a bubble and look at it and say the revenue growth, at least the valuation is too stretched, just have to look at the revenue growth numbers, and it's difficult to deny it. So if I look out to, over the next couple of years, even with reasonable projections, I mean, consider that NVIDIA has been doubling revenue. And if you look at that and take your estimate for 2026 and say it's only going to maybe got 50% in revenue, and then 2027 only by 26%, it still puts it on a very reasonable price to sales. So where did it come from? I mean, it's a unique technology that is absolutely critical if you're going to build an AI data center. We're seeing massive amounts of spends coming from, typically it's four or five biggest customers, which account for almost half of its revenue, but you can guess who they are. They don't disclose it publicly, but it's Microsoft, it's probably Tesla, it's Alphabet, and they're spending enormous amounts of money building out these AI data centers, and NVIDIA is benefiting.
Sure. And this milestone reached all the while contending with Taurus, more so on its AI chips.
Yeah, so that's, I suppose, if you look at NVIDIA and I think the risks around it, the tariffs and the regulation specifically around their sales in China is absolutely key. So obviously we've seen regulation really constraining their ability to sell their H20 chips into China. And that's meant that they had to take significant impairments. Fortunately, the company was able to almost repurpose some of those chips and reuse it in other parts of the business as well. So yeah, the impact was less than everyone expected. But the idea that the White House is shutting down, you know, NVIDIA's ability to sell into China, I mean, has widespread ramifications. And as the CEO was talking about on the most recent conference call, you've got to be careful of this kind of regulation. It's not just about NVIDIA being able to sell its technology into China and whether or not that's going to limit Chinese tech dominance. But the fact is that probably half of cutting-edge AI scientists live in China. And when we saw DeepSeek, the DeepSeek model coming out, China, you know, has the ability to develop this technology and run this technology, even with the infrastructure it's built at the moment. So what the result could be of this heavy regulation is that AI, that Chinese developers end up building on a non-US network. And if that happens, the U.S. inadvertently, by over-regulating the chip industry, actually hands you know, part of the industry to China. So yes, that is always going to be, I suppose, a concern around a company like NVIDIA and many of the big tech companies is this heavy regulation. So yeah, they're definitely something to be cognizant of.
Fair enough. I guess what we're hearing is that you are expecting this upward trend to continue in light of your first answer, and maybe just taking a look at other tech companies. What then does this mean, hearing news on the pressure that is being applied, whether directly or not, to Apple's CEO? And so how are they reading all of this?
Yeah, so looking at other tech companies, so obviously NVIDIA's market cap now eclipsing Apple. I think everyone was hoping Apple would be the first tech company to hit that $4 trillion mark. But looking at it, you compare the big tech companies and Apple at the moment, they're also facing the same kinds of pressure from the White House to onshore a lot of their development. And unfortunately, moving iPhone factories, they've kind of been developing them in India and moving those into the US now. That's no small feat. And if you look at the kind of tooling engineers that are required to build an iPhone, the US just simply doesn't have that capability. So Apple, I think is maybe a little bit more fragile than some of the other tech companies, especially if you compare it to something like Alphabet, which obviously has, which is essentially Google, and with that, a much more diverse base of products that they're selling. And if you look at it even in valuation terms, you compare something like Nvidia to Alphabet, for example, a lot cheaper in terms of earnings. I think you're trading at a sub 20 PE on Alphabet. You compare that to something like Clicks, which trades on more than 30. And if you consider what's sitting underneath that, yes, you've got all the AI development. They create their own what's called TPUs, which is a tensor processing unit. They also obviously buy heavily from NVIDIA. They've got their Gemini program. But they've also got YouTube in there, which is, I think it's bigger than Netflix at this stage. So, yeah, a lot going on.
Thank you so much, Gary. A lot going on. Gary Boyson of Rand Suisse.
The Standard Flexible Income Fund is designed for pre- and post-retirement income and capital preservation needs. Retire without regret with Stanlib Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Listening to market commentators, as an investor, you are by now no doubt familiar with the words uncertainty, nervous, volatile, inviting you to really assess your investment portfolio. Dirk Yuster is a fund manager at PSG Asset Management, and he argues that with markets set to remain volatile, you need to carefully consider retaining a meaningful allocation to growth assets. He joins us on the line to expand. Thank you very much for your time this morning, Dirk. So you argue that a volatile environment makes the case for multi-asset funds, low equity multi asset funds. How so?
Yes, good morning, and good morning to all the listeners. Yes, we are probably entering an era that's going to be more volatile than we are used to. So I think the lower risk or lower equity type of funds can play a very interesting role, just helping investors navigate a more volatile environment that is typically also linked to tougher emotions when it comes to investing. So it can play a very important role in this environment.
You also caution against knee-jerk responses to news flows, often taking into account longer-term consequences.
Yes, that's right. Sometimes investing can be quite emotive, and when the news flow turns negative, it's quite easy behaviorally to withdraw from investment strategies that's a bit more volatile. But there's a great risk or danger in this that typically when the emotions do run high, at most times quite a bad time to withdraw from higher equity risk strategies. But we are definitely heading into an environment where a lower equity mandate can definitely help with these emotive times in the markets and help you remain invested.
So you essentially are calling on investors to find ways of maintaining and growing their wealth.
Yes, lower equity risk mandates, they can strike a very comfortable balance between remaining invested to a certain degree within equities, but then also it can use other asset classes to smooth the journey and make it a little bit more comfortable for investors and yet still achieving an objective of beating inflation over medium and longer term time horizons.
Mm-hmm. So you've touched on the sort of disadvantages of early withdrawals. What about an investor who's saying, well, maybe I should be conservative, maybe I should be cautious? Is there a danger to investing too conservatively, in the long run at least?
Yes, no, absolutely. I think investors, you know, you have to manage quite a few risks, but probably the biggest risk that you do need to just be aware of is the risk of being invested too conservatively for long periods of time. Now, this is typically where investors allocate to strategies that does not utilize equities. And equities are the asset class that does provide the possibility of very large inflation-beating returns. So the risk for investors is actually quite acute, not taking advantage of inflation-beating returns in the long run. And at the end of the day, it can play quite a meaningful role in terms of the longer-term outcomes. So investors just need to be quite careful not approaching the markets or their savings and investment strategies with too much conservatism.
What do you say to an investor who's having a conversation with themselves about cash versus equities and debating that?
Yes, so we've come out of an environment where fixed income or cash and bond funds, so typically we would call these multi-asset fixed income funds. In South Africa, we've had very good real returns on offer, and they've been able to deliver quite nice inflation-beating returns. But the risk is going forward that the fixed income returns might be moderating, and we do expect or anticipate low real returns coming from this space. So longer term, it's quite a risk to only take advantage of this asset class and ignore equities for a longer-term time horizon. And with a very low allocation to equities alongside other securities like the traditional fixed income securities, investors can get to quite nice inflation beating returns over longer term time horizons.
So the overall message that we are hearing is keep calm in the midst of a storm, reassess your portfolio and be in it for the long run.
Yes, that's right. And lower equity multi-asset funds can help these investors along the journey. It strikes a very comfortable balance between growth and lower volatility, while also being able to generate very nice inflation-beating returns. It also takes away the task for investors of making these asset allocation decisions. A multi-asset low equity mandate like the PSG Stable Fund takes these equity allocation decisions away from the investor, and it will blend across a various and a very wide toolkit to deliver a comfortable journey and good inflation-beating returns as well.
What of the multi-asset income fund?
Yes, multi-asset income funds have played a good role. We've seen typically investors using higher equity solutions coupled with multi-asset fixed income solutions. But what a low equity multi-asset multi-asset solution does provide, it does take away the decisions how you blend those two asset classes. And again, we do think the multi-asset fixed income, although it's delivered very good outcomes over the last, let's say, medium to a few years, we do see the returns moderating from this space. So there is a risk that you will not generate the same inflation-beating returns as you have experienced in the past. And so the multi-asset low equity solutions can play a very good role in blending these asset classes together, adding a little bit more equities to the mix, but it will likely result in much better inflation beating returns in the future, which we do think is important for investors that still can take a slightly longer time horizon.
Thank you so much for your time this morning, Dirk Uster, Fund Manager at PSG Asset Management.
Let your money weather the storms with Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in the Stanlib Global Select Fund, a diversified all-weather equity portfolio sub-managed by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
It's the month of July, and that means it's National Savings Month, which is observed every year in South Africa. And new data from BrandMap highlights how the country's mid to top income consumer class of 13.5 million adults earning over 10,000 rand a month are navigating savings and investments amid economic uncertainty. Brandon de Kock is BrandMap's Director of Storytelling. He joins us now to take a look at this data. Thank you very much, Brandon, for your time this morning. Maybe let's start with the concept of a consumer class. Who are you talking about?
Hi there, Judy. Yeah, so the consumer class is a term that we've coined. Well, we didn't coin it. It was coined, I first heard it by a chap called Professor Haroon Borat from UCT. It describes the group of people around the globe. It was an attempt at a global study a few years back, trying to identify who sits in society as in the group of people who can freely buy goods and services above their basic sort of survival needs. Mm-hmm. And we think it's a pretty good description of this group of people. You know, the moment you hit 10,000 rand a month in household income, you're talking about the taxpayers, the personal tax base of South Africa. So that's what we mean by consumer class. We're not saying that people, the 70% of the country who sure. sit under that mm-hmm. line, don't spend money or don't have money. It's just that a lot of them don't freely use that cash to do anything other than put food on the table. So that's mm-hmm. what we mean by the consumer class.
Okay. And your data suggests that the tide is turning, because previously when we mark Savings Month, it's always been about financial literacy being at a low level in mm-hmm. South Africa. But it would appear that the tide is turning?
Well, I think when you talk about this group of people, and it's a fairly significant portion of South African society, you are talking about a highly educated group of people. It is the educated, employed masses of South Africa. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them have learned to deal with their finances in a very different way. So, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about the bottom of the pyramid, and we should obsess about it. You know, we should obsess about helping people who are not doing so well. But let's not forget that there's a massive group of 13.5 million South Africans who really aren't doing too badly. The way I always put it is, if you've got a job and you've got the education to understand how to use that money more wisely, I think is the best way to put it.
Sure.
You're not in as bad a place as the overall picture would suggest. So yeah, we see this group of people being incredibly resilient in the post-COVID era, and they certainly have a little bit of cash to save and to invest.
Cash, they say, is king, because a notable number of those you surveyed in terms of a saving or investment vehicle, they choose to bank cash. It's the most popular choice for them.
Absolutely. It's not a new thing. We do a lot of work with the major FSPs of South Africa, and it was something pointed out to us a while back by our clients. Was they kept stopping on these charts and going, hang on a moment, you're telling us that banked cash savings is the number one savings and investment vehicle that these people use. And we're like, yep, like 30% of the entire consumer class claim that they have bank cash savings. Hmm. So money in the bank, I always say, it's like food in the freezer. If you're in Cape Town at the moment, you don't need to put your food in the freezer. You can just leave it outside. I think it does make sense. You know, it's a... In a world of uncertainty, you never know what's going to happen in global politics that's going to send your investments tumbling. Somehow it feels that cash in the bank feels like a fairly safe place to store whatever you've got left over, you know, even if it's waiting to see what else you can do later.
So the usual suspects are their burial schemes, pensions and retirement annuities. They remain strong, but fewer people are investing in shares and unit trusts, as you've just outlined. Do we get a reason as to why? Is it because of the geopolitical uncertainty that we're seeing now, or is there another reason for this?
We see quite a high correlation between shares and some funnily enough, and the concept of gambling. Mm-hmm. I think that shares, when you think about it, shares really are a gamble. You're taking a gamble on trust to the corporation that it's going to do what it promises to do. And we see it as very small. You know, the imprint of shares is less, just less, or right around about 15% of all the consumer class have some sort of share portfolio. And it really is a gamble. You know, you've got, well, unless you're very, very clever and you understand how to read all of the charts and graphs that you sort of read on the inner pages of the business news, you know, shares are tricky to understand. And I think that's the other key thing about understanding investment vehicles. The, you know, this consumer class we're talking about has more than doubled in 10 years in size. You know, it's a massive growth. And there are a lot of new to category consumers that sit in there, people who don't necessarily have some sort of generational legacy of understanding what a unit trust is or a deep understanding of the share market. So slightly, let's call them less sophisticated vehicles are always going to be more attractive. So cash in the bank, super easy to understand. Burial scheme, really easy to understand.
Crypto?
And that's where we see the majority going.
Sorry, Brandon, crypto. No. What are we seeing with crypto sector, rather?
So crypto, if shares have an element of gambling to them, we see crypto as being, you know, it's basically the lotto. You know, there's a lot of talk about crypto, and there are a lot of the crypto guys. I know that one of South Africa's major platforms claims something like 6 million clients, but they also claim an average investment of less than 1,500 rand. So we think crypto still seems to sit in that gambling environment. It appeals massively to the younger market. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the crypto investment is by consumers under the age of 25. We see those people just, you know, dropping whatever small amounts they have.
Yeah.
The young generation is clearly interested in crypto, but it doesn't yet feel like it's sort of in the top echelons of investment vehicles. You know, it's more of a gamble.
Very interesting.
I mean, do you know a lot of people who've got heavy investment in crypto?
Maybe one or two, and those are like professionals. You know, they know what they're doing.
Exactly. But, they're the same people that understand shares.
Sure, you know? Sure. But thank you very much. Very interesting insights, Brandon. Appreciate your time this morning. Brandon de Kock, BrandMaps Director of Storytelling.
This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. And that's it from myself and the team for the week. We are live every weekday morning on the MyWeb website and app at 6:30 a.m. and podcast just after 7 a.m. A big thank you to the team that has held my hand this week, Eddie, Nabuhle, and Nicole. And of course, a big, big thank you to Simon Brown for trusting me with this baby. I'm so relieved he's coming back on Monday. Nobody does this better than him. And a big thank you to you for choosing us and listening to us and bearing with me this week. Have yourselves a magic Friday and a magic weekend.
Listen to the live stream of MoneyWeb Now at the same time every weekday. For more business, finance, and investment news, MoneyWeb Now on the Money. Also available on podcast.